Tonight on Arena, The Tree Whisperer, a news plot set and performed in the Botanic Gardens. And we preview Apple TV's The Crowded Room, starring Amanda Seyfried. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. The Tree Whisperer is an outdoor play written and directed by Matthew Raleigh and starring Jean Rooney and Pat Ryan. The title character is a druid, an expert in trees and woody plants, and a woman with a unique ability to communicate with trees. Over the course of the play, the Tree Whisperer tries to help a man who comes to her looking to solve an old riddle and to locate what he says is an important family heirloom which is hidden somewhere in the National Botanic Gardens. That venue in Glasnevin in Dublin is also the setting for the play's performances, which begin this day next week, June the 14th. And with me in studio this evening, writer Matthew Raleigh, the Tree Whisperer herself, Jean Rooney, and Pat Ryan, who plays a character simply referred to as the client. This is the man who's attempting to solve this old family riddle. Who came up with the idea of a tree whisperer? I suppose it has to be you, Matthew. You've a background in horticulture, seemingly, yeah?
I do, yeah. I'm a qualified horticulturalist. In my younger life, I worked as a landscape designer and landscape gardener in Australia.
And are you a secret tree whisperer?
Well, maybe. Or plant whisperer. I certainly would have an affinity with plants. And I think, as I would have worked as a gardener with plants, and I think a lot of gardeners would have, you know, feel this way, that when you spend time with plants, you do sense an affinity with them at very least, if not a full-blown conversation.
So would you coax your plants on with little bits of encouragement when you're in the garden?
Perhaps, yeah. I think that probably does happen.
You have to admit to everything now, Matthew. There's no point in hiding.
I'm sure, like in the privacy of my own gardening, I probably do. Yeah, I do, I'm sure.
What sort of things would you say to them, Matthew?
Come on now. No, I don't know. Just put on the spot here. Yeah, you just encourage them.
You encourage them.
How amazing they're looking. Or if they're not doing well, try to encourage them to do better.
Yeah. It's a bit like how he speaks to his actors.
Yeah, exactly the same.
Is it a bit like actor whispering? Is there something similar in it? But Jean, you are the woman who plays this tree whisperer.
Indeed.
And she knows, it would seem from the script, absolutely everything about trees, and particularly about the trees in the National Botanic Garden. Little did I know that skill set was there in your background.
I'm telling, it's on my CV. I am Oracle 2 when it comes to the trees, Sean. Yeah, that would be called acting on Jean Rooney's part. But I'm getting there on the job. I have learned quite a lot, it would have to be said, in the last 2 weeks.
I would say, I mean, because there's quite a lot. In some ways, maybe explain who she is. Even giving us her name will tell us what she thinks about herself.
Well, her name is Fraxinus Excelsior. So Fraxin, she likes to be called, which is the Latin for the common Irish ash. And she, when you say, what does she think of herself? There's no thinking. She is a tree. Mm-hmm. She is a tree trapped in a human's body. And that is a fact. And she's also, I suppose, she presents like a druid so that people maybe, take her a bit more seriously, because druid is something they can kind of believe in. And then she is a little bit tentative about saying it, but utterly is, she knows to her own soul that she is a tree.
And not only that, all of the trees that she brings us to, because this is an outdoor piece.
Yes.
It's performed in the National Botanic Gardens. Mm-hmm. All of the trees that she brings us to, she not only has their Latin names, she has little pet names for them as well.
They are absolute pals. They are her friends, her family, and she refers to the fact that she doesn't have any children. And she is, I suppose, to some of them, when they need it, she's quite maternal, but also she is guided, and she is minded by some of them as well. So it's a two-way relationship, but it is a very real, true, and very deep relationship, actually.
Yeah.
It's lovely.
I presumed, Pat, that Pat Ryan, who plays this man who comes to the Botanic Gardens, who comes to Frax, as we have to call her, I suppose.
Fraxin, yeah.
Fraxin.
You can call me Fraxin.
Call me Fraxin. He comes to Fraxin with this riddle that has to be solved. You must have been delighted when you heard that she was an ash tree, as a good Limerick man, The thought that you'd get near an ash tree must be a good thing. Or are you not from Limerick? Is it real trouble now?
Oh, no, I'm Limerick through and through, yeah. So anything to do with ash there the last 5 years, we've been pretty happy. You know, I don't know about this weekend now. We're on tender hooks, as the fella says.
Obviously,
you know,
referring to the hurling stick and the clash of the ash.
I am, certainly, yeah.
So explain to me then, this fella who comes in, quite hard to get to know, certainly initially, Pat, and he refers to himself, or he's referred to in the script, simply as the client.
Yeah, he's very cagey initially because, you know, he's been around the Botanic Gardens trying to solve this riddle, and he encounters this woman on the internet. So he comes to meet her to help him solve the riddle. But initially when he meets her, she just seems a little bit off centre. So he's very wary of her, and he desperately needs her to help him solve the riddle. So he comes to her. So he's very, very cagey with her. But as we go through the play, it's not that he warms to her, but starts to see that there's a little bit more going on with it. Maybe she might get through it despite her odd nature, for want of a better word.
The section that you're going to read for us, is this where we get a sense of the kind of the nature of the riddle that's involved, or what's involved here, Jean?
Yeah, we do. We are first introduced to the riddle in the bit we're going to read, and we're also introduced to, I suppose, the first time that she chats to a tree, and that's how the scene begins. And we also get a little bit of the initial, how shall I say, maybe distrust from himself towards her. Yeah, and she's not a bit fazed by it. She just, you know, she's really true to herself throughout, and no matter what he throws at her, doesn't bother her. She's with the trees, and we also hear the riddle.
Yeah, she feels safe in that particular
environment.
So we have to imagine ourselves into an outdoor space here specifically, if you can, and you know the National Botanic Gardens, you can imagine yourself into that space, and we'll have a little bit of the conversation then between Fraxon and the client.
Marvellous. Well, here we are, one of me favourite trees. Hello, Miss Cova, me old dear. And may I say, you are looking more majestic than ever. Oh, you cheeky mare. She wants to know what you lot are doing, wasting your time following me about. Well, these are friends of mine, you old rogue. So get it about that they're to be looked after while they're here. No funny business.
Are you going to look at the bleeding letter or what?
Did you bring it? The original, like?
Why? You have a copy.
I told you, I need to feel the original if I'm to connect to it. It's how I work.
Fine. Here. But careful. It's old.
How old would you say?
I don't know.
You've not had it verified. But how do you know it's real then?
Because the family, a story passed down about an heirloom. I said all this in my email.
Yes, heirloom, right. Must be worth the pretty penny to go to all this effort, like.
No. It's not. Its value is sentimental. The belongings of a great, great, great uncle of mine who was, he might have been a revolutionary. Bit of a black sheep in the family, and that. Look, I prefer not to go into it, what with everyone watching. So, what do you think? How old would you say it is?
Well, by the feel of the paper and the type of ink, I'd say Edwardian, between 1900 and 1910.
Okay.
And if you were to push me for an exact year, Joe, I'd plump for 1907.
Jesus.
Sound about right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess. I don't know.
Now, the rest of you have probably all had a chance to read this tasty conundrum before us today, but I'm thinking it won't hurt to hear it out loud for the trees to bear witness, like, if nothing else. So, Joe, would you read out what I'm calling the riddle? Though 'tis no such thing, really. It's more like a list of vague directions. So, go on now.
It rests between the dead and Talca.
Which we know means the National Botanic Gardens.
The Caucasian guards the path. Stop to weep, but beware, to pine is to be poor. And besides, you'll find the Spanish equally sweet. Big Red offers all, save what you seek. A cornfield of shipbuilders is a rare sight, as is a star fallen to earth, 5 paces out from a crooked prince. What do you think?
As clear as mud.
It's clear as mud indeed. And that's Patrick Ryan, Pat Ryan there, as the client, or Joe, which is what Fraxin, which is the tree whisperer of the play's title that Jean Rooney is playing there. She calls him Joe at this point along the way. Real sense of the riddle there, but I suppose even you can pick up a sense within the phrase that we got from Jean and Pat there, Matthew,
yeah,
that we're going to be guided around the various trees of the Botanic Gardens. In fact, to what extent is this as much a guide to those trees as it is this mystery that's going on as well that Pat brings in with him, the riddle?
Yeah, I think it is twofold. I think it is the riddle and the solving of this riddle and the mystery around this riddle for both of them to solve and for the audience to also to be aware of too and trying to understand it. But also it is a guide to introducing the audience to a number of really lovely trees in the Botanic Gardens and learning a little bit about each tree. Mm.
Yeah, because as Jean was performing there, we heard you saying those that are standing around, or Pat's character also saying about, I don't want to be doing it in front of all these people. So that's a reference, obviously, to the fact that the audience would be there. This goes back to lockdown and the idea of outdoor pieces. This is where this started off.
Yeah, so Bewley's Café Theatre brought this initiative during lockdown to be able to at least offer some theatre when there were restrictions to indoor theatre. So it was an idea to get theatre outside. Mm. And it was so successful that they've just kept it going. And it's really great. It does bring people outside. And it provides playwrights and different theatre makers with an opportunity to come up with something quite different because of the different settings.
I would guess too, Pat, you know, rehearsing this in a room is one thing. Have you made it out to the gardens yet? Have you started rehearsing it in situ? Because that will bring a whole... Even just the energy levels to perform outdoor are totally different, I would have thought.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So we did start indoors, as it were, and we started to move out. So I think for the last few days, we've been out in the Botanic Gardens. And no, it did change the dynamic straight away, you know, because like you said, you're outdoors and, you know, you have to lift the energy as well and not lose the detail that Matt has plotted in through it, you know, and the minutiae of the characters as well, you know. So and the story we're telling, like, you know, so that there's been a lot of hard work in that, but I think Matt's been brilliant, like, just guiding us through it, you know.
Yeah, because Matt is obviously directing the piece as well. How, like, we hear in the character of Joe, or the character of the client as he is at that point, we find out more about him as the play goes on. He's really wary of this whole tree whispering idea. Have you found yourself warming to the idea of tree whispering, warming to the idea of even hugging the trees and talking to the trees out in the Botanic Gardens?
Oh, God, yeah. Would I go as far as hugging a tree? I don't know. But, I mean, there's one particular section. I won't say where it is, but actually all of it, every section. When you isolate a tree and really study and look at it, they're magnificent, you know. Mm. And I did read a book a couple of years ago that myself and Matt did talk about. It's called The Secret Life of Trees. And as certain researchers are now finding out that trees do communicate, like, electronically through molecules and things like that. Mm. So, I mean, it's a fascinating and deep area of science and study. And for want of a better word, there's almost a magic to it, you know what
yes.
I mean? And I think even the title of The Tree Whisperer, it's, and the fact that Matt has brought in mythology from, you know, the Celts and the Norse mythology as well. It's very deep. So I certainly wouldn't be cynical about it. Do you know what I mean? And then because the character
would be more cynical than
very,
you
very
are.
Cynical and disparaging of it.
Yeah.
And
although we find, without giving too much away, he finds his way into maybe taking more on board than he expects. Certainly in the section we just heard. For you, Jean, what was that process like? Because really, you've never mind believe that the trees can talk, think and feel and communicate with each other. You are a tree. I mean, we all spent school plays being a tree and being very disappointed about it, but not in this case. You have a lot to say.
Listen, I have spent 27 years waiting for this moment, you know, since day one of drama school. I am now finally a tree. And, oh, it's just, yeah, because you have to leave all cynicism. The very first day Matt spoke to me about it, he said, now listen, I've got to be really clear about this. There is no, you know, is she a tree, isn't she? She's a tree. And when you take away that cynicism, it makes it so easy. Mm. It has completely freed me to just, and I love just totally embracing it when she's chatting to them, when she's listening to them. oh, I'm in it. Like, I really, it is gas. Like, I totally believe it. And, like, even things like if you're looking up in the Botanic Gardens, like, it is so beautiful there. And as people will follow the path, you know, Matthew has thought really hard about what is the path we're following.
Yeah.
And when you look up in certain trees,
it's a real guide. It's a trip around the National Botanic
stunning.
Gardens.
Yeah. I think people will stop noticing Pat and I eventually. And just look,
at the trees. One final question, if I could, Matthew, and you'll know what you want to tell me or not tell me in this. There is a bit of history that links into this whole story here, a bit of which is kind of half history, half myth as well. How much do you want to tell me about what the riddle is about or what the family heirloom is about?
The family heirloom and the riddle is about a certain type of treasure that the client believes he knows what it is and he is desperate to find it, and he feels like it could free him economically and also solve a really big problem that he has within his family. But the stakes are high.
The stakes are high. That's acceptable to go no further than that. I'm not surprised you don't want to give it all away. Thanks to all three of you for coming in this evening. That's writer and director Matthew Riley, actors Gene Rooney and Pat Ryan. The Tree Whisperer opens at the National Botanic Gardens in Glasnevin this day next week, June the 14th. It runs Wednesday through until Saturday and then Wednesday through until Saturday the following week as well. You can find out full details on BuleysCafeTheatre.com. According to Groucho Marx, politics is the art of looking for trouble, finding it everywhere, diagnosing it incorrectly, and applying the wrong remedies. Of course, for centuries, it has fallen to artists to call out the inadequacies of political decision-making, whether overtly or through more nuanced means. Naturally enough, the form of the moving picture provides a means for serious art to make serious points about the world we live in, whether through films that present statesmen on screen or stories about the people enduring the hardship of the trickle-down consequences. Here to delve into politics in cinema is Stephen Benedict. Plenty of examples here. Good Night and Good Luck, JFK, The Iron Lady, In the Loop, not to mention series on the small screen like The West Wing, House of Cards and The Thick of It. Before we talk to Stephen, here's a ballot of pictures for you to vote on.
You're an hypocrite.
I uphold the law.
The law means nothing to me. I've had no say in making the law.
That's an excuse. It's all we have.
We break windows. We burn things. Because war's the only language men listen to. Because you've beaten us and betrayed us and there's nothing else left.
I was born by the river.
Before there was any such place as America.
In a little tent.
We were black.
Oh, and just like the river I've been running.
Corruption is our protection.
Ever since.
Corruption keeps us safe and warm.
It's been a long.
Corruption is why we win.
A long time coming, but I know.
Jerry Conlon, lifer, 30 years sentence.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
I'm saying that when the president does it, that means it's not illegal.
No, I have to do this my way. You tell me what you know, and I'll confirm. I'll keep you in the right direction if I can, but that's all. Just follow the money.
Just follow the money. Clips there from Suffragette, Malcolm X, Syriana, where we had the oil man telling us why corruption works, In the Name of the Father, Network, Peter Sellers in Dr. Strangelove, Frost Nixon, and then finally that follow the money line from All the President's Men. Burning political issues of several forms, obviously, within the midst of all of that. Stephen Benedict, as I say, with me in studio this evening. Stephen, when you listen to that, and that's only, you know, that's only scraping the surface, really, you know, political cinema. There are so many political stories out there, and you could guess, you could say All the President's Men is the daddy of all political films, but it's not always about the people up at the top. It's quite often about a much smaller type of politics, I suppose, politics with a small p.
Yeah, I think they work best that way, because most filmmakers and most financiers understand that when a film is too political, when it gets on its soapbox, audiences are turned off. And so what they try to do is they disguise the politics behind the drama, disguise the politics behind the personal issues of it. And so audiences are then just looking at the personality. So if you look at Suffragette, for example, it's personified by Kerry Mulligan. And it's about women and the right to vote. Malcolm X is about racial equality. Dr. Strangelove is about nuclear war. In the Name of the Father is about a father and a son. And yes, there's politics there if you go to look for it, but you're not going to be putting it up on the poster. This isn't sort of, you know, movies from the Soviet Union in the 1950s about a boy, a girl and a tractor. You're going to be very, very, very much personalizing the story. And I think they work much better that way. You're absolutely right. All the President's Men, I think, is considered to be the granddaddy of them all because it's about arguably the biggest conspiracy in American history. Right, but in the political sense.
In some ways, even though it is about that big political moment, we're looking at it through the eyes of the two journalists and we're looking at how can they tell this story and what are the ramifications of all of that. It's humanised in the film down to that investigation, isn't it?
Completely, because we understand that Woodward and Bernstein actually were in their late 20s, early 30s when the story broke. Mm. And they had just arrived, Bob Woodward had just arrived at the newspaper. And he had to learn his way. And he really didn't know the inside track of Washington politics at all. There's a very famous scene in the movie where he has to be told who the Attorney General is. And he says, you know, you've heard of Richard Nixon, have you? There's a great line in that movie. So, you know, they do personalize it because these are not experts, because the audience had to be, although the audience in 1976 had lived through the Watergate hearings, they didn't want to present that on screen as it happened. They had to, as you said, personalize it and dramatize it, to turn into a thriller effect.
And also what that type of, you know, the journalist not knowing, it allowed the audience to be told maybe bits that they were unsure of, and an international audience mightn't have known all of the tiny little details.
Well, even, and the great thing is that line, that clip you played, Follow the Money, was never said in the case at all. It was made up by William Goldman, who's writing the screenplay. He condensed the whole thing down to CREEP, the Committee to Re-elect the President. It's all about cash.
Yeah, and, you know, the truth is always stranger than fiction, as we know only too well. But you were talking there, how close to the Watergate scandal did All the President's Men come? Because topicality is always an issue, really, with political films, isn't it? Particularly the ones that are dealing with the higher up level of politics, if you like.
Yeah, and the problem there is that what appears to be a big story this week is gone next week, as we know a week is a very, very long time in politics. So I think that's one of the reasons maybe why financiers and filmmakers tried to shy away or tried to stay away from a very, very hot topic, because it could have faded by 18 months' time. But there's a case in point. I remember it was about 5 years ago that there was an item on Morning Ireland and it was about a homeless family. And Roddy Doyle just happened to be listening. Yeah. And he literally went up to his study that morning, having finished listening to the radio, and he sat down to write the script called Rosie. And within 18 months, the movie was actually in theatres, which is very, very quick and almost the point of being unheard of.
Let's have a listen to a clip from Rosie here, played by Sarah Green, this title character, the woman who's looking for a home, or
housing to live. Children.
They have nowhere to go on
a
daily basis. They're looking for somewhere.
In fact, living in a car.
So she's phoning around looking for accommodation while her children are doing their homework in the car.
What is it?
It's Mommy!
Mommy! Mommy!
Shh, I said. Hiya, I'm looking for a room for a few nights. I got your number on a list I was given.
It's not fair with me, though.
Yes, it is.
Okay. Thanks.
Be quiet.
Bitch. I didn't say that. She was, though. It's a copy. It's hardly there at all, look it.
Read it out to me, home, will you?
I'm doing my homework.
No. It's only a few phone numbers, Kaylee. I'm not asking you to abandon your education. Come on. We'll find a hotel and then I can start looking for a new place. A house, like.
That's Sarah Green there in the film Rosie, the Roddy Doyle script, as Stephen Bender tells us, based on hearing a headline on Morning Ireland and then running with it and writing the fictional version of it there. In many ways, now Roddy's script, I would guess, is much more structured than a Ken Loach script, even though we had a great sense of interaction between the kids and the mother there, almost improvised. But Ken Loach was doing precisely that type of thing in his filmmaking all along. Today's headlines, today's story.
Yeah, and it's amazing to think that Ken Loach's career has, I mean, this is a compliment, has lasted so long, despite the fact that he's so politically loaded as a filmmaker. I think he was nominated this year for the 18th time at the Cannes Film Festival. But, you know, if you're talking about Rosie, it goes back to the 1960s, because one of the most important, still to this day, one of the most important pieces of drama ever broadcast on Irish or British television is Cathy Come Home, which was broadcast in 1966.
It was also about a homeless situation. Yeah.
That's right. Cathy Come Home is about, you know, a young couple, and they fall behind the rent, they get evicted, and then their children are taken away from them by social services. And the politics is there, front and centre. But because it's so personal, it is phenomenally upsetting and distressing to watch. I mean, any time I show to the students in school, in the National Film School, they just can't believe what they're watching. Yeah. Because it's so vividly done. And it's so vivid. It's so authentic that it depoliticizes it and it augments the personal.
And that's exactly what Rosie does. It's the same type of thing. Because there's barely a politician in sight in those films. You might be dealing with some of the various agencies that are involved and the bureaucracy of all of that, institutional side of things, but you don't see the higher up politics.
No, because
it's not that type of discussion.
Well, that would kill it.
Yeah.
Because all of a sudden you feel as though you're reading a newspaper or you're reading a manifesto, and all of a sudden the person is no longer a person. They just become a mouthpiece for the political viewpoint.
But then there's a balance to be struck, isn't there, between, you know, yes, you don't want a political soapbox going on all the time, but also if you over sentimentalize something, the audience probably will turn from that as well as that's too small, that's not believable.
It's mush. Yeah, I think, you know, the origins of cinema, you can trace it back, I think, to the 1890s when cinema was born in the 1890s. The novel was in its realist phase, and you had French writers, and I mentioned the French because cinema began in France. You've got Zola and Balzac and Flaubert. And they were harsh realists. But then if you go to England, you've got Charles Dickens. And what Dickens did, he had his characters criticise institutions. So he personalised it. And, you know, greatest storyteller as Dickens was, my problem in, you know, as an adult reading him, as opposed to reading Oliver Twist as a child, but reading him as an adult, the only solution he ever provided for anything was a moral one. If only people were nicer, everything would be better, which is simply not possible. Okay, and so the thing is that cinema went the Dickens route. It embraced his sentimentality. Okay, and you can see that very, very clearly, very, very quickly in Charlie Chaplin films, which are really political to the point that Charlie Chaplin was almost drummed out of America on the accusation of being a communist.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the films are the Charlie Chaplin
modern
is the
times.
Modern Times is the ultimate anti-war film, really, isn't it?
Well, no, that's The Great Dictator. But
it's
Modern
Great
Times,
Dictator, sorry. Yeah,
the Modern Times is about working in a factory.
Yeah.
And it's all about economics and it's all about big business. And anybody who isn't a big businessman is going to lose their way. So it was very, very politicised. But because you're looking at The Little Tramp, it's incredibly sentimental. But it's brilliant storytelling. But it is very, very sentimental.
And I guess there are those who would argue if you read the Dickens novels, maybe as opposed to the films, that there is more argument within those than you can put into a film.
Yeah,
there isn't space for that type of argument.
Yeah.
But In the Name of the Father, then, which we heard at the beginning, this is the personal, the highly political in terms of when it was set and what was happening in terms of Northern Irish history, and indeed the historical in terms of the Irish, as the British would have called it, the Irish problem. They're all mashed together in this story.
Yeah, and the brilliant thing about it is, I mean, it was so so quick. We were talking about quick turnarounds. I mean, when were the Guildford Four released? And the movie comes out in 93. So the very, very fast turnaround. And I think one of the reasons why it was such a successful film is because Jim Sheridan and Terry George, when they were adapting the book and turning it into the movie, and because it was financed by the Americans, Universal Studios were financing the picture, they were looking for how can we maximise our investment on this film, on a return. And Terry George and Jim Sheridan looked at the story and they said, well, really, we don't want to politicise it because it won't travel to Brazil. And we're going to make a love story between a father and a son. And I think, I could be way off the mark here, but if you look at it, it's the story of Pinocchio, okay? Because Jerry gets into trouble, just like Pinocchio. And his father, Giuseppe, goes off in search of him. And they both end up in the belly of the whale. And I think that's the key to the film because it completely personalises the story. You're not looking at successive British governments on a soapbox, you know, and you don't have Sinn Féin or the IRA figures or anybody giving these very, very opposed political positions. It's about person. It's about people and the tragedy of an injustice and a love story between a father and a son. That's what it comes down to, I think.
Well, certainly you can't ignore the injustice because that's at the
very
heart of the film, and that story is quite definitely told. But the father-son thing is a big part of the story, no question about that. Let's have a listen to a clip, Pete Postlethwaite, wonderful performance as Giuseppe, confronting his son, Daniel Day-Lewis, as Jerry in the jail cell. It comes down to just that, a father and a son. No politics. They're not talking about United Ireland's bombings, mm-hmm. who's doing what and who's involved in what particular activity. They're having a good old daddy boy, son row.
Why do you always follow me when I do something wrong? Why can't you follow me when I do something right?
What are you talking about?
Huh? What am I talking about? I'm talking about the medal.
What medal?
The medal I won at football. And you was on the sidelines shouting instructions. Like, you could only see what I was doing. You couldn't even play football. And you could only see what I was doing wrong. I could never do anything good enough for you. And after the game, you came up to me and you said, Jerry, did you foul the ball? And I walked away from you. Do you remember now? I walked away from you into the dressing room. You followed me in there. And you said again, Jerry, did you foul the ball? And all the other fathers were in there. They were laughing at you, calling you poor Giuseppe. And I ran out and I hid. And I wrote your name on the ground. Your stupid Giuseppe name. I wrote it in the dirt and I pissed on it.
It's so strong that, you know, that's Giuseppe Conlon played by Pete Postlethwaite, Daniel Day-Lewis playing Jim, Jerry Conlon, yeah. I beg your pardon, in Jim Sheridan's film, In the Name of the Father. And I was saying as we were listening to that, and I don't think I'm putting words into Jim Sheridan's mouth, he'd say that scene was about him and his father as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think Jim Sheridan spoke about when the movie premiered and his father was in the audience, and his father came down to embrace his son, Jim. He says, I love you. Mm. And Jim Sheridan literally pushed his dad away because he'd never heard such an intimate, affectionate, honest, open, candid line from him. And then Jim Sheridan said, and he died very soon after that. So you had this phenomenal tension. I mean, Bono talked about how do you dismantle an atomic bomb. And I think that's what we were looking at, we were hearing in that clip.
Yeah, and the fact that he remembers that he's carrying that thing about the football team from whatever age he was.
I mean, the next line that Giuseppe delivers, he says, this is shock. At least the father recognises what his son is going through. He's suffering an emotional breakdown.
And it's a phenomenal film in that respect, how it brings all of those things.
One of the greats.
All of those things together. Right, so then, if you had to come up with the three top political films, where would we be going?
I think it's unfair you're limiting me to three.
Hard luck.
Yeah, okay.
It's a political choice, that one.
Okay,
Stephen.
All the President's Men, In the Name of the Father. But if you're talking about three, that maybe people would be a little bit off the beaten track.
Right, okay. I'll allow you that.
Yeah, we'll go with The Grapes of Wrath, an adaptation of John Steinbeck's novel from the early 1940s, directed by John Ford, starring Henry Fonda as Tom Joad. And it's about the Oklahoma Dust Bowl, and they're moving west to look for work. And it's more than just looking for work. It's trying to stay alive. And
it's a family story,
isn't it?
They're
being brutally exploited by these big businessmen who are paying them pittance because these people need money to survive. And that is it's an emotionally pulverizing experience. I watched it about a month ago. Superb film. The next one I'd go is way off in the other direction. It's The Battle of Algiers from the mid-1960s, directed by Giulio Pontecorvo. It's an Italian-French co-production about the Algerian War of Independence. Hugely influential. It's influenced people like Steven Soderbergh, Spike Lee. If you look at Bloody Sunday, directed by Paul Greengrass, the documentary approach from the Battle of Algiers turns up in Bloody Sunday.
And is the Battle of Algiers, is it more of an historic, is it telling that historical tale and the politics of it rather than personalising it too much?
No, it is political, and that's a fantastic thing about it. It finds room for you to discuss and find issues such as colonialism and interrogation and torture and terrorism, which tragically are still very, very relevant. The last one I'd mention is The Lives of Others, the movie about the communist system in East Germany in the 1980s. I went to a German school, so maybe that's the personal connection that I have. And I grew up, a lot of the students in my school, their parents had actually fled communism. So the history of this movie is very, very palpable. But for me, it shows how communist regimes turn against their own citizens and exposes really, really clearly to the core the toxic, literally carcinogenic reality of communism, because the East German government exposed the citizens to radiation. So they could track them more easily in the streets, and that's what the movie exposes.
And it's the surveillance, the methods of surveillance, and you know, neighbors
sickening.
Snitching on neighbors because they were afraid if they didn't snitch,
what would happen
to them?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Incredible stuff. However, I think The Grapes of Wrath is probably what we should finish up with, and let's go out on listening to a clip. Paul Guilfoyle as Floyd Knowles, agitating here for the rights of migrant workers.
You men want to work?
Sure we want to work. Where's it at?
Tavares County. Fruit's opening up. Need a lot of fruit pickers.
You doing the hiring?
Well, I'm contracting the land.
What's your paying?
Well, can't tell exactly yet. About 30 cents, I guess.
Why can't you tell? You took the contract, didn't you?
That's true, but it's key to the price. Might be a little more, might be a little less.
All right, mister, I'll go. You just show us your license to contract. Then you make out an order. Where and when and how much you're going to pay. And you sign it and we'll go.
Now listen, smart guy. I'll run my business my own way. I got work. If you want to take it, okay. If not, just sit here, that's all.
Twice now I fell for that line. Maybe he needs 1,000 men. So he gets 5,000 there and he'll pay 15 cents an hour. And you guys will have to take it because you'll be hungry. If he wants to hire men, let him write it out and say what he's going to pay. Ask to see his license. He ain't allowed by law to contract men without a license.
There you go. The debate that is part of The Grapes of Wrath, one of the three top political films that Stephen Benedict has chosen for us on this Wednesday evening. This Friday and Saturday, June the 10th and the 11th, Smock Alley Theatre in Dublin hosts two performances by Irish folk artist Hibson. It's all part of their annual Bloomsday Festival. Hibson, centred around musicians Gráinne Hunt and Jim Murphy, is named in reference to the lasting influence of Henrik Ibsen on James Joyce. The current album is called The Stern Task of Living, 15 strong collection on the 15 stories in James Joyce's Dubliners. Let's go to the third of those stories, third track in the album as well, Araby, which of course tells the story of a boy who falls in love with his friend's sister but fails in his quest to buy her a worthy gift from the Araby Bazaar. That's the story. Here's the song.
Gifts for all the leaves have died. Tomorrow at the dawn.
Track called Araby there from Hibson, the folk band, and that's from their current album, The Stern Task of Living. Songs inspired by the stories in James Joyce's Dubliners. And Araby, or Hibson that is, will be performing the album this Friday, June the 9th and 10th at Smock Alley Theatre with a 10-piece ensemble, in fact, including a string quartet, called Musici. And that's all part of the Bloomsday Festival. You can find out full details of all of that on smockalley.com. The Crowded Room is a new series from Apple TV, draws heavily from Daniel Keyes' 1981 non-fiction novel, The Minds of Biddy Milligan, starring and executively produced by Tom Holland of Spider-Man fame. It follows Danny Sullivan, a man who was arrested following his involvement in a shooting in New York City in 1979. Danny's life story unfolds through a series of interviews with what is called a curious investigator, Raya Goodwin, played by Amanda Seyfried, revealing elements of the mysterious past that shaped Danny's life and the twists and turns that will lead to what Apple TV Plus are calling a shocking revelation. Dave Hanratty has been watching The Crowded Room for us and he's with me in the studio now. This has been a long time making its way onto the screen, Dave.
It really has, yeah. There was talk of this being a film helmed by James Cameron in the early 90s, and not quite his style, you would think, because it's not really a blockbuster per se. It is based on a real life figure. We can try and get into that if we can. Mm. And then that fell apart. There was a lawsuit about who owned the rights or how much was paid, etc. He left the project. Then there was talk in the 90s of Joel Schumacher or David Fincher picking it up as a movie. That never happened, of course. Actors who were linked to the lead role, now played by Tom Holland in this TV show, included the likes of Johnny Depp, Brad Pitt, Sean Penn, Matthew McConaughey, John Cusack. None of that happened, of course. And then in 2015, it was announced that Leonardo DiCaprio's production company bought it, and he was going to star in the lead role, a role that he apparently had wanted to play for over two decades, or almost two decades. Then that fell apart, and now we finally have this.
Tom Holland.
In a 10-episode TV show. Yes.
Right. Now, I don't know where to start in terms of Apple TV are, you know, there's all sorts of things we're not allowed to talk about, we're not allowed to say. But this is based on a true story and a book called The Minds of Biddy Milligan. It's not as if it's a, you know, it's some piece of fiction that they're kind of holding and hooking us in, even though they're presenting it in a kind of a thriller type of way. But all the details are out there.
this is the weird thing. And like, you know, I don't want to go all inside baseball here and potentially alienate the listener and be like, let's have the woes of the critic. But critics have been asked to not reveal certain things to quite a forensic level of degree here, which would speak to how the show presents itself, which is it is based on a real life person. Names have been changed, but it's right there. You've mentioned the book title twice. The title of the book is in the opening credits of every episode. So if you just Google that, you can get the real story straight away and not have to watch the 10 episodes.
Although there are people who have discipline and they can watch a series without Googling the true story. It's hard to do.
In this day and age,
yeah. But it is possible to do that, to just watch it as a series and let the story unfold in front of you.
It is possible to do that. I mean, this real life figure that we're talking about has actually been the subject of a Netflix documentary a couple of years ago. You may have seen that, you may not have. This could be your very first time. This could be a brand new story for you. And it's how they tell the story that I have got a lot of problems with, because they essentially turn this into not a guessing game per se, but there's a lot of things being withheld from you, the viewer.
Yeah.
A lot of wheel spinning. And again, I just don't really understand why they took this approach. I think it would have been better to be more out in the open with what is going on, because there is very much a what's really going on thing to run through this show. And it takes a very long time to actually drop that other shoe.
Yeah, for them to really admit what's going on. But as you say, if you look at the book, even if you know nothing about the story, you look at the title of the book, it'll tell you an awful lot. You can very easily surmise what's involved. However, I'm laughing at they keep calling this Amanda Seyfried a curious investigator. Now, I know they mean that she's curious, she wants to find out, but it sounds as if she's some kind of odd, unusual investigator. What is her role in the midst of all of this?
Yeah, I mean, like, you'd want your investigators to be curious, wouldn't
you? You would kind of want them to want to ask the odd question.
Basic job description. Amanda Seyfried, great actress, recently getting a lot of acclaim for The Dropout, and has been in, like, everything from Mean Girls to Mamma Mia and various other things as well. Doesn't get a lot to do here. She is curious, as it says. I mean, I think determined might be a better word. Invested might be a better word, because she is that. But in the way that this show, I should say, is kind of set up is, for the most part, you have scenes of Amanda Seyfried on one end of a table, Tom Holland on the other end of a table, and she'll ask him a question of, like, well, what happened here? Then we get these very long, very languorous flashback sequences with Tom Holland playing a teenager, which doesn't quite work. And then back to her asking the questions again. She does eventually get a bit of character development, but for the most part, it's a very passive role. Yeah,
she's just asking. She's the cipher that asks the
conduit to move the story forward. Yeah,
I suppose what we do need to know, even before we listen to this clip from one of those, I think it's their very first encounter in the interview room. And in fact, the opening sequence is very tense and is very effective. It lasts about maybe 2 or 3 minutes. Maybe describe what we see there.
The opening scene, which kind of sets a bit of a different show, it's quite thrilling. You have Tom Holland on a train going to Rockefeller Center in 70s New York, late 70s New York. He's accompanied by a character played by Sasha Lane, the always great Sasha Lane, and a violent shooting will occur following thereafter, and, you know, an arrest goes down. It's all very over the top in a dramatic way. But again,
it's like the beginning of a crime story rather than a true story in many ways. And it has that kind of tense feeling to it. Who are they following? Who are they going to shoot? All of which will be revealed as the investigation goes on. However, so after that, he's brought in for questioning. And Amanda Seyfried, as you say, is the curious investigator asking him the questions here.
How are they treating you?
It's like everybody else, I guess.
I'm just here to talk.
About what happened with Ariana, I know.
Do you know where she is, Danny?
No. Like I told the police, I haven't seen her since what happened on the street.
Well, the police can't find her either. What happened to Yitzhak, your landlord?
I don't know.
Well, if you can't tell me where they are now, can you tell me how you ended up living with them in that house?
It was a rooming house. I was rooming there.
Danny, I'm trying to help you.
Okay.
Amanda Seyfried there as Raya Goodwin, the investigator, and Tom Holland as Danny Sullivan in Apple TV's The Crowded Room. And you get a sense of what you were talking about there, Dave Hanratty, that really she asked the questions and we get a sense of a character within him, but, you know, not very much for her to do other than ask those questions. So what about the character that Tom Holland has to present here? that so many actors wanted to play from what you told us at the top of the item.
I can see why actors wanted to play this character. There's a lot of historical significance with this real life person. Again, I'm dancing around the details just in case you're going into this blind. I don't want to ruin it for you. There's a lot to play with for an actor in a dramatic sense. And I can see why Tom Holland was attracted to this role, because, you know, he's been absolutely brilliant as Peter Parker and Spider-Man in those movies. Mm. He is the beating heart of those films. He is genuinely great. And he can do drama. He does drama even in those films on occasion. So this feels, though, to me like an actor who wants to kind of, you know, kind of unpretty his image a bit and just kind of do something a bit darker, a bit edgier, and show the world what he can do. You know, get out of the Marvel Cinematic Universe for a moment. You know, there's scenes here that, like, those scenes that you heard there kind of reminds you a bit of Mindhunter, that sadly cancelled Netflix show. That's a better show, though, I should say. It's no surprise when an actor wants to do this, wants to kind of break bad, so to speak, and play this kind of multi-layered figure. I just don't think he's right for this role, unfortunately.
I've only seen the first episode where we see a lot of flashbacks to his time in high school and the beginnings of his meeting the Sasha Lane character and Yitzhak, the landlord, that's mentioned in the midst of all of that as well. And it takes a long time even for that to be fleshed out, and we find out how they first met. Do those flashbacks continue right throughout the series?
For the most part, yeah. I've seen 7 episodes of the 10-episode season, and, you know, there's a lot of wheel spinning, a lot of standing around, and at a certain point, I think if you've seen, you know, a decent amount of television and films and read a certain amount of genre fiction or whichever, I think you'll kind of crack the code, and I think you'll realise why some of these scenes are there.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, once that kind of drops with you, you wonder why the show hasn't actually been more upfront with you, the viewer.
And the other side of this is there's been a lot of complaining around the casting of Emmy Rossum as Candy, Tom Holland's mother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's in real life. Emmy Rossum is 36 years of age. Tom Holland just turned 27. And you get flashback scenes where he's a teenager and she's the mother. She's got a bit of old age makeup on her, but it doesn't really work. You get other flashbacks to before then, where it makes a bit more sense. And she's a really good actor as well. But that is jarring, I have to say. And I think Tom Holland, even like with his dress up and his horrendous haircut in this as well, it just looks like cosplay. It looks like an actor going to the 70s, you know, the costume designer just like off screen, out of shot. Money was spent. They always are with these shows. But I just didn't buy it. It didn't feel authentic to me.
Let's listen to a clip featuring Danny's mother, Candy, played by Emmy Rossum. And Danny is in this as well as his stepdad, Marlon, played by Will Chase. And he's not the nicest man in the world, it has to be said. So he's getting ready. Danny's about to head off to school, but there's a bit of a row in the house.
I gotta go. You know, how come you and me never spend any time together no more? Hey, look at me when I'm talking to you, okay? Why, you don't like me?
Danny, let's go. I can't be late. Get a move on, please.
Gotta go. Respect me in this house, mister.
Marlon, what the hell is going on here? Take your hand off him.
Oh, that's so? You gonna make me? What are you...
Danny, go.
Yes. Yeah, Danny. Go.
You're pitiful.
Yeah, well, I'm all you've got, Candy, so what the fuck does that say about you?
Have a nice day.
Lunch.
Apologies, a bit of language at the end of that clip there from Will Chase as Marlon, and Danny played by Tom Holland, Candy played by Emmy Rossum from the crowded room. That family dynamic, how important is that? Again, I know you have to dance around stuff here to a certain extent, Dave.
Yeah, it's important. I mean, it shapes the character to come. And, you know, again, based on a real life story where these elements were apparently present, it's clearly not a happy childhood. And that has a major effect on the young adult life and the adult life that will follow. So, and what I was kind of saying to you just there off mic is that, like, these are real details and they shouldn't be danced around, and the show does detail them. But the show handles this like genre fiction. It handles it like a trope. Yeah. It handles it like an expectation, and it doesn't land it with the weight that it needs to give you.
Is that ultimately your problem with it? Because clearly this is a problematic series for you. Is it that, you know, the fact that this is a real life story being handled as if it were a piece of genre fiction?
I think it's been mishandled, yeah. I think from the approach that they chose to take instead of the story that they could have told, I think that they chose to go in one direction, and ultimately it's kind of fatal for the show. Some people might be drawn to it and might be like, look, you know, it's a potboiler, you know, it has certain beats, but I do think it has been kind of mishandled from a core level here, and that kind of shines through by the end. I've seen some people call this a fiasco, and I wouldn't go quite that far. I don't think it's a disaster, but I do think it's a failure.
Okay, not a disaster, but certainly not a success is what you're saying in that. Dave Hanratty there talking to us about The Crowded Room, which will be available on Apple TV from this Friday, and that is our lot for this Wednesday evening. Liam Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Andrew McDermott was the broadcast coordinator. Ruth Kennington was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme was produced by Reg Luby. Talk to you tomorrow night, once again, 7 o'clock here on RTÉ Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.